Preacher had no intention of letting Blanton take the farm away from his father. If the bank demanded gold coin in order to retire the debt, then Preacher would come up with the gold coin. Whatever it took to get control of the farm returned to his father, Preacher intended to do. The first requirement would be to find a bank that would honor the drafts from the riverbank of St. Louis. That in itself shouldn't be hard, though it might be somewhat more difficult to find a bank that would pay in gold coin rather than paper money. This was Preacher's original home place, but he had grown to adulthood somewhere else. Because of that, he really knew very little about this area. In order to find a bank that would meet all the requirements, he would have to have help from someone, and he knew exactly who that someone would be. He walked down the street to visit with his brother-in-law. Preacher thought his brother-in-law's establishment would be closed at this time of the morning, so he was surprised to see that Vaughn Roberts had already opened the Riverman's Inn for business. When Preacher stepped inside, Vaughn looked up at him from behind the bar.
Good morning, brother-in-law.
Morning. Preacher looked around the inn and saw that there were several people sitting at the tables. I wouldn't have expected you to have this many customers at this time of day. Seems a little early to be drinking, don't it?
Not if you're drinking coffee.
Coffee?
In the afternoon and at night, we are what some may call a tavern. But you notice we call it an inn, not a tavern. So we open in the morning and have quite a brisk breakfast trade. A lot of men, especially the bachelors, come in here for coffee and strudel. Your sister makes the best strudel in the county. She's won prizes at the county fair.
Well, I didn't know that about her. Actually, I'm ashamed to say I know nothing about her or many of the rest of my family.
You have a wonderful family, I'm happy to say.
Tell me about them. Last night, I'm afraid that all I did was fill everybody in on where I've been and what I've done for the last 15 years.
All right. I'll start with your sister, Betty. She was a school teacher until she got married, and she was a very good one. But as I'm sure you know, the school board has a strict rule against teachers being married. So when she and Jim got hitched, she had to give up her job. There were a lot of disappointed families in the area. Families whose older sons or daughters had been in Miss Cooper Smith's class and who wanted their younger children to have her as a teacher as well. Betty's husband, Jim, publishes a newspaper, and even a governor has read and commented on some of his editorials. There are some who think Jim should run for office, but he insists that he can do more good as a newspaper man by, in his words, being the watchdog of the public. Your brother Morgan, like your father, is a farmer. He works hard and is honest in his dealings with others. His wife Anne happens to be my first cousin, so if I tell you what a wonderful person she is, you'll just say I'm being prejudiced.
No, I just figure you had a real clear idea of her. Thank you for filling me in on all of them, Vaughn. But I must say, after seeing how well they all turned out, it's clear to me that I'm the black sheep of the family.
I wouldn't say that.
I know they were all shocked to see me just drop in out of the blue the way I did.
They may have been shocked. Who wouldn't be to have you suddenly show up after such a long time? But I'll tell you this. I know they were all very happy to see you. Oh, where are my manners? Would you like some coffee?
Well, yeah, thank you. That'd be good. And one of my sister's pastries. I left the house before breakfast this morning. A moment later, Vaughn served Preacher. Preacher took a bite of his sister's strudel. Tell Tess this is very good.
You can tell me yourself.
Tess appeared in the doorway of the kitchen. She was wearing an apron upon which there was a light dusting of flour. An errant strand of hair hung down across her eyes, and when she brushed it back, she left a smudge of flour on her cheek. All right, I will tell you. This is very good.
Thank you. Arthur, what are you doing here? You aren't leaving again so soon, are you?
No, not just yet.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And don't think I'm not happy to see you, but I think you should spend more time with Mama and Papa.
I will. It's just that I have some business to take care of with Kleist Blanton.
Kleist Blanton? You're doing business with that disagreeable man? Has Papa told you about the loan on the farm?
Oh, yeah.
Everything was going just fine until Blanton bought the bank and began foreclosing on all the farmers. Why did he have to go sticking his nose into everyone else's business?
Well, some people are just like that, I guess. But I do think that Blanton will be more careful about where he sticks his nose from now on.
What do you mean?
Oh, nothing. Just making conversation.
What kind of business do you have with Kleist Blanton?
Mortgage business. Vaughn, if you were going to use a bank other than Blanton's bank,
use a bank other than his.
You do? You mean there's another one right here in town? Which one? Where is it?
No, I didn't mean to give you the wrong impression. It's not in Portsmouth. The bank I use now is the Ohio Bank for Savings over in Alexandria.
Alexandria, huh? Yeah, I remember passing it on the way here. It's about 10 miles downriver, isn't it?
Yes, Alexandria isn't as large as Portsmouth, but it does have a good bank. In fact, since Kleiss Blanton bought out the bank here in Portsmouth and turned a good bank into a bad one, a lot of our local folks are doing their business over in Alexandria.
Who's the head of the bank over there? You know him personally?
Yes, I do know him. His name is Bert Rowe. He's a good man.
Arthur, if you're going to go over there and try to arrange a loan for Papa, I can tell you right now it won't do you any good. Vaughn had a new loan all set up, but Papa wouldn't do it.
Why not?
Because Papa says you can't borrow yourself out of debt.
Yeah, well, he's probably right. But that's not what I have in mind.
Oh?
I plan to pay off Pa's notes so that he has the farm free and clear.
Arthur! You have enough money to do that?
Yeah, and I have it with me. But it's not in cash, it's all in bank drafts.
Bank drafts are fine. Why bother to go over to Alexandria with them? Blanton is the one who's holding the note. Why don't you just do business directly with him?
Well, like I said, Blanton and I had a brief discussion about that very thing this morning. He says he won't honor the drafts, and it's his right not to do so.
I guess I'm not all that surprised that he won't do it. I have believed all along that Blanton isn't really interested in having the note paid off. What he actually wants is the land. He's got his hands on several thousand acres of prime bottom land right now, and your father's land is as good as any piece of land in the entire county. It may be the best land in the county. I'm sure Blanton is just itching to add your pa's lands to his holdings.
Yeah, well, he may want pa's land, but he's not going to get it.
Arthur, does Papa know you're doing this?
No, and don't you tell him until it's already done. I'm afraid he'd try and stop me.
You're absolutely right about that. He would try to stop you. Papa's a proud man who won't accept a handout from anybody, not even one of his own children.
Believe me, Tess, when I tell you that this is not a handout. The way I look at it, this is just payment for all the hurt I've caused Mom and Papa, and that I've caused all of you over the years. I'm hoping that once it's done, Papa will look at it that way too.
He will. I'll talk to Betty and Morgan, and we'll make certain he sees it that way.
Thanks. Tess leaned across the counter and put her hand on Preacher's. You could smell the scent of cinnamon and flour and brown sugar. For just a moment, it caused him to recall his youth. Many times over the past several years, on those long, lonely nights in the mountains, he would sometimes think of his family, and he couldn't think of his mother without recalling that homey aroma. It seemed right and good now that his sister would be carrying that on.
You're a good man, Arthur. I was very young when you left, and I'm afraid I don't remember you all that clearly now. I've often wondered where you went and how you turned out. I'm glad you came back, just so we would know what a good man you really are.
Well, now, don't get me wrong. I'm not a saint, Tess. I've done things that I wouldn't want Ma or Pa or, hell, even you or Betty or Morgan to know about.
You went out on your own when you were 12 years old, Arthur. I've no doubt that you had to do some things to survive. But survive you have, and here you are today, offering to pay off the farm for Papa. Whatever you had to do in the past, you are a good man today, and I love you for it.
Thank you, Tess. I appreciate that coming from you.
Good morning, Ed. What's gotten into you this early in the day?
Vaughn! Pour me a cup of coffee and bring out one of your wife's strudels, and I'll tell you the funniest thing I've heard in a long time.
Ed sat down at the bar. Vaughn poured him a cup of coffee, then set a piece of strudel in front of him.
All right, Ed, just what is this funny story?
Hey, you know that fella that bought out the bank? The high and mighty Kleiss Blanton.
Yes, of course I know him. He's so damn disagreeable, he's made himself known all over town.
Yes, sir, that's the one, all right. But you just wait till you hear what happened to him.
Wait a minute. Are you saying something happened to Kleiss Blanton?
It sure did. And Cletus Buttram seen it happen. So according to him, this is the gospel truth.
What happened?
Blanton got his comeuppance. That's what happened. Mrs. Roberts, every strudel I have here is better than the one I had the day before. How do you do that?
Oh, I just follow the same recipe my mama and grandmama used. But tell us what happened to Kleiss Blanton.
By now, both Tess and Vaughn were staring at Preacher, who seemed to find something interesting to study in his coffee.
Well, it seemed like some fella come into the bank this morning to discuss something with Blanton. Well, I reckon the discussion didn't go to the fella's liking, so he took out his knife. Then, without so much as a by your leave, took him a slice out of the side of Blanton's nose. Just like that.
What do you mean when you say took him a slice? Are you saying this man cut part of Blanton's nose off?
Well, no, not exactly. He just sliced right through it. Leastwise, that's what Cletus is saying.
And Cletus is saying that all this took place in the bank?
Yeah, in the bank. Right there in Blanton's office, according to Cletus.
What about Colby and McDougal? They don't strike me as being the kind of men who would just stand there and watch all that happen without doing something about it. I thought they never left his side. Where were they when all this was going on?
Well, sir, according to Cletus, they was right there in the bank at the time and seen everything that happened.
They saw it, but they didn't try to stop it?
Oh, yeah, they tried. That's the best part. According to Cletus, this here fellow handled the two of them like they was no more than babies. Had them sitting on the floor, he did, staring at the wall, like the way the teachers sometimes do with their dunces.
You don't say.
Now the apprehension in Vaughn's face was gone. And he looked at Preacher with awe in his eyes and a smile on his lips.
Chris Dumy seen Blanton a while ago, and he said Blanton's nose was all red, with a purple scar where the cut was. The scar wasn't all that big, but you could sure see where it was. No, sir, I don't reckon the high and mighty Mr. Blanton is going to be so high and mighty anymore.
Tess looked at her brother.
So, Clace Blanton is going to be more careful about where he sticks his nose, is he?
Yeah, well, my opinion is that'd be the wisest thing for him to do.
Be more careful about where he sticks his nose. Yeah, I reckon he is all right. That's a good one, that is. I'll have to remember that while I'm telling this story.
Well, I think I better be going. Tell me, Vaughn, can I rent a horse at the livery?
No need for you to be renting a horse when I can lend you one of mine. And I guarantee you, you'll be better mounted on my horse than you would if you rented.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Also, before you leave, I'll write a letter of introduction to Mr. Rowe. That might be helpful to you in case he has questions about why you want gold instead of paper for the bank drafts.
Well, yeah, thank you, Vaughn. That'd be a big help. Colby and McDougal knew that Preacher would have to go to Alexandria in order to find the bank that would honor the bank drafts. So even as Preacher was in the Riverman's Inn, Blanton's two bodyguards were on their way to Alexandria. They got there ahead of Preacher and waited in the saloon, taking a table near the window so they could keep an eye on the bank, which was located just across the street.
You think he'll get the gold?
I reckon he will. But he ain't gonna keep it long, seeing as how we'll just meet him out on the road somewhere between here and Portsmouth and relieve him of that burden.
Yeah, well, if it was up to me, I'd do more than take the money from him. I'd kill the son of a bitch.
And you'd get hung for it, too. Hell, you'd get us both hung.
I just don't like the way he'd done us back in Portsmouth.
Well, me neither. I've never seen anyone move as fast as he did.
Yeah, well, if and he hadn't already pinned you to the wall with that knife, I would have had a shot at him. I could have killed him then, and it would have been self-defense.
Yeah, well, why didn't you?
Because I told you, you was in the way.
Sure, so you say. But truth to tell, when you come running into the room, he's already standing there with his gun drawn, pointing right at your innards.
Hey, wait a minute. Ain't that him coming up the road there?
Colby looked out the window in the direction McDougal was pointing.
Yeah, that's him all right. Could be nobody else dressed like he is. Them buckskins and that hat.
They watched Preacher ride the length of the street and stop in front of the Ohio Bank for Savings. Dismounting, he tied his horse off, then went inside.
Mr. Blanton was right. He come right here to this bank for his gold, just like he said he would. All we gotta do now is wait and watch.
Armed with the letter Vaughn had written, as well as the letter Constable Billings had given him back in St. Louis, Preacher presented himself to Bert Rowe, the head of the bank. Bert read both letters.
They are good letters. They speak well of your honesty and integrity. Now, what can I do for you, sir?
I need to cash these bank drafts. They're for $600.
Certainly. I see no problem with that. Step over to the teller's cage. I'll instruct him to honor the drafts.
I'm going
to
need the money in gold coin.
Gold coin?
Yeah.
Why, gold coin. We issue United States Bank promissory notes. They are as good as gold everywhere.
As good as gold isn't gold, though. I don't mean to be picky, Mr. Rowe, but I'm paying off the mortgage of my father's farm. Clyde Blanton holds a paper, and he's demanding payment in gold in order to release it.
I see. Blanton is the kind of man that gives bankers a bad name. Very well, Mr. Cooper Smith. I'll honor the drafts with gold coin. I'll even put them in a bag for you.
Well, that'd be right helpful. As Rose searched for a cloth bag, Preacher happened to glance toward the wall, where there hung several posters. One poster in particular caught his attention. He walked over for a closer look. As he examined it, he felt a surge of anger and determination. It read, "Wanted for murder, dead or alive. Murderer is missing his left ear." Bert Rowe came over to Preacher then, bringing the cloth bag and the money.
"Here is your money. I couldn't help but notice you looking at that Dodger."
"Yeah. What do you know about this?"
"Terrible thing, that."
Rowe then proceeded to tell the story of Billy and Susie Potter finding their parents dead on the floor.
"They were murdered, both of them. Billy chased him with a pitchfork, but the man was mounted and rode away."
"How were Mr. and Mrs. Potter killed? Did the murderer slit their throats?"
"Yes. Say, how did you know that?"
"Because that's the way he works."
"The way who works?"
"Ben Cavanaugh. Could you tell me where the sheriff's is located? I may have some information for him."
"Sheriff Wallace's office is just across the street down on the corner. You can't miss it. It's the only brick building in the block."
"Thank you." McDougal and Colby watch Preacher coming back out of the bank carrying a sack.
"Look at that there sack he's carrying. Looks like he got the gold."
"Yeah, but he won't keep it very long. I'm gonna enjoy taking it from him almost as much as I would killing him. Let's go."
But to their surprise, Preacher didn't remount. Instead, he walked across the street, still carrying the sack of gold. They watched as he went into a small brick building that sat on the corner.
"What the hell? He's gone into the sheriff's office."
"Yeah. The question is, what's he gone in there for?"
"Maybe he's gonna have the sheriff ride back to Portsmouth with him to guard the money."
"No, a sheriff ain't gonna do something like that. He'd have to hire him a private guard."
"Well, maybe he's going to the sheriff to find out where he can come by someone like that."
"Yeah, that could be, I suppose. But to tell you the truth, the way that fella handled himself, it don't seem to me like he'd be needing no private guards."
"Guess we'd better just wait and watch."
"Guess so."
Sheriff Wallace, a gray-haired man of about 50, was sitting at his desk filling his pipe with tobacco when Preacher came into his office. He looked up at Preacher with curiosity.
"Yes, sir. Mister, something I can do for you?"
"Sheriff Wallace, my name is..." Preacher started to identify himself as Preacher, but thought of the letter his brother-in-law had written for him, so he used his real name, Art Cooper Smith. "I wonder if I could speak to you for a moment."
"Sure thing, Mr. Cooper Smith. What do you have on your mind?"
"First, I'd like to show you this." Preacher handed Wallace the letter Constable Billings had written for him, appointing him as his temporary deputy. The sheriff read it, then handed the letter back.
"This letter calls you Preacher."
"That's a name some folks call me." Preacher showed the sheriff his letter from Vaughn.
"All right, Preacher, or Mr. Cooper Smith, whichever name you prefer. This first letter says you are a deputy in pursuit of a criminal, and it asks for my cooperation. I'll be glad to cooperate with you all I can. We're a pretty small town, and I know everyone here, so I can tell you for a fact that the fellow you're looking for, this, Ben Cavanaugh, isn't in Alexandria."
"He probably isn't, but I believe he was here."
"What makes you think that?"
"I was just in the bank, and I noticed you have a Dodger posted on the wall. You had a murder take place here recently, committed by a man with only one ear."
"Yeah, he killed Hiram and Emma Potter."
"I'm pretty sure that may be the same man I'm looking for. Mr. Rowe said that the Potter's son and daughter saw the man."
"Yes, they did."
"I wonder if I could speak with the boy and his sister."
"Yeah, I'm sure they'll talk to you. Are you mounted?"
"I am."
"Come on, I'll ride out to the Potter farm with you."
McDougal and Colby watch Preacher and Sheriff Wallace come out of Wallace's office together.
"Wait a damn minute. That sheriff ain't acting like he's guarding nothing. This is something else."
Colby was right. When Preacher and Sheriff Wallace left the sheriff's office, they mounted and rode, not towards Portsmouth, but in the opposite direction.
crap!
There they go! What the hell do you reckon this is all about?
I don't know, but I reckon about the only thing we can do is trail them and find out what they're up to.
Oh, hot damn! Now we're riding and watching.
Colby and McDougal trailed Preacher and the sheriff, always remaining some distance away so they could keep up with what was going on without compromising their presence. When they saw Preacher and the sheriff heading toward a small farmhouse, they dismounted and moved their horses into a clump of trees so they could watch without being observed.
You know who I think that is?
Who?
I think that's the Potter boy. You remember it was in the paper back in Portsmouth. He's the one somebody killed his parents.
Yeah, I remember that. What's he talking to Coopersmith for?
I don't know. But as long as the sheriff's there too, there's not much we can do but just wait and watch.
Aw, shit! I'm tired of waiting and watching.
Me too. Get mounted. We're heading back to Portsmouth.
What? Didn't you say we was gonna take that gold off of him?
Yeah, and we are. But not while the sheriff's around. I don't know what all this is about, but I got me a feeling that it don't have nothing to do with us. So I figure the sheriff will go back to his office in Alexandria while Coopersmith takes the gold back to Portsmouth. Don't forget, he wants to pay off the loan so he can get his pappy's farm back.
Yeah, all right. Let's go.
At the Potter farm, Susie was working in the garden while Billy was up on the roof of the house, replacing shingles. He had just reached for another shingle when he saw two riders approaching.
Susie, something's coming.
Susie looked up and used her hand to shield the sun from her eyes.
Who is it? Can you tell?
Looks like the sheriff is one of them, but I don't know who the other man is.
I'll make some lemonade. No doubt they're hot after their ride.
Billy left his shingles on the roof, then climbed down the ladder. He was standing in front of the house when the two riders arrived.
Sheriff Wallace.
Billy, this is Mr. Coopersmith, but he goes by the name of Preacher.
You're a pastor?
No, it's just a nickname people have hung on me and I'm comfortable with it.
I see you're keeping busy, Billy.
Yes, sir. Pa kept telling me that we was gonna have to put shingles on the roof this summer, but I kept putting them off because I didn't want to do the work. But I put it off too long. During the rain last week, the roof leaked something awful.
Yeah, when shingles go bad, roofs will do that. How are you and your sister doing?
Doing all right. We miss Ma and Pa, but we're doing just fine. Come on in. Susie's making some lemonade.
Thanks. Sounds good after a hot ride.
The three men went into the house, where Susie greeted them with glasses of the confection.
I just drew the water from the well, so it should be cool.
Susie gave each of the men a glass.
Billy, Preacher thinks he knows who the fella is that killed your Ma and Pa.
Billy looked at Preacher.
You know the man?
Yeah. If he's who I think he is, he also killed a woman in St. Louis a few months ago. I've been looking for him ever since.
I wish you had found him before he got here.
I do too, miss. I'm very sorry for your loss. But I tell you this, if it's any comfort to you, I will find him.
It won't bring Ma and Pa back.
No, it won't do that.
What's his name?
His name is Cavanus, Ben Cavanus. He's a big man with dark hair and a crooked nose, and he's missing his left ear.
That's him!
How'd he lose that ear? What he's got left is about the ugliest thing I ever seen.
The woman he killed had a dog with her. Dog chewed the ear off.
Good for the dog. Too bad he didn't kill him.
There were two men who attacked the woman. The dog did rip the throat out of the other one. He killed him.
Good.
Billy, Sheriff Wallace said that you ran after Cavanus, but he was riding.
Yes, sir. He was riding a bay. If he hadn't been mounted, he'd be dead, because I'd have caught up with him.
He went that way, east. Of course, he could have turned a different direction after he was out of sight. I think about that, about him still being out there, and sometimes I'm afraid at night. Afraid that he may come back.
I told her I wish he would come back. He got away from me once. If he comes back, he won't get away again.
He won't be coming back.
You say that like you know it for a fact.
I do know it for a fact.
Where's he heading, you know?
Yeah, he's going to Philadelphia. After they finished their lemonade, Preacher and the sheriff took their leave. As they headed for their horses, the sheriff saw several rust and iron washers lying on the ground under a tree.
You got a lot of iron washers there, Billy. What are you planning on doing with him? Going into the iron washer business?
You remember now, don't you, Sheriff, how Dad used to run a float line out in the river for catfish?
Indeed I do. I had more than one mess of your pa's fish.
Well, he used these iron washers as his weights for the fishing line. He'd like to gather them up, but I don't have any use for them.
You mean you don't fish? I figured as good a fisherman as your pa was, you'd be out on the river too.
Nah, Dad enjoyed it, but I didn't. I wish I did enjoy it. I think Dad would have appreciated it if I had gone fishing with him, but I never did. I just don't have the patience, I guess.
What are you going to do with those washers now?
I don't know. Bury them, I guess.
Well, I'll give you $2 for the lot of them.
You give me $2 for these?
Yeah, for the whole pile. What do you say?
I'd say you got yourself a deal.
Preacher gave Billy $2, then scooped up all the washers and put them in his hat.
What are you going to do with all them things?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I'll go fishing. Colby and McDougal had already started back towards Portsmouth. Almost exactly halfway between the two towns, the road made a curve around a rather large outcropping of rocks.
Oh, right here! It's perfect! We can see him coming and he won't see us!
They ground hobbled their horses, then took up a position that allowed them to see nearly a mile down the road. Then they waited and watched. Colby slapped at a fly. Dougal got up.
Where you going?
To take a piss.
Colby turned his attention back to the road.
Woo-wee! Look at this!
Look at what?
I'm trying to piss this here grasshopper off in the weed, but the little son of a bitch just grabbed a hold and is hanging on.
McDougal, you are one odd fucker, you know that?
McDougal came back to the rock, buttoning up his pants as he did so.
See anything yet?
No. If I had seen something, I'd have told you.
They waited and watched for several more minutes.
I hate waiting and watching with a goddamn passion.
Hey, look, here he comes.
And the sheriff ain't with him.
Colby pulled a hood from his saddlebag and slipped it on over his head.
Finally, let's get the job done.
Preacher was riding back to Portsmouth when two men suddenly appeared in front of him, jumping out from behind a rock. Both men were wearing hoods over their faces, with nothing but tiny holes for their eyes. Both were armed, and they had their pistols charged and cocked, leveled at him. Had it not been for the fact that they were armed, Preacher might have laughed at them. The hoods over their heads did absolutely nothing to conceal their identities. Colby and McDougal were still wearing the same clothes they'd had on in Blanton's bank earlier this morning. Preacher put up his hands. All right, my hands are up. What do you want?
I want you to untie that there money bag from your saddle pommel and hand it over here.
Slowly, Preacher did as he was told, handing it to the one who had extended his hand. The robber tied the sack to his own saddle pommel.
Hand over your gun, too, Cooper Smith.
How do you know my name?
Maybe I got the mind powers.
Preacher was pretty sure that mind and power were two words that had never been strung together to describe this man.
What's so damn funny?
Oh, nothing. Sometimes I chuckle when I'm terrified. It's a nervous thing.
That's right, you're terrified. Now give me your goddamn gun.
Preacher gave Colby his pistol.
Now get down from your horse.
All right.
What you going to do with him?
This is a tricky son of a bitch. I am to make sure we get away. Grab his horse and let's go.
Preacher stood in the road and watched as the two robbers left with his horse, money bag, and pistol. With no choice but to walk, Preacher resumed his journey back to Portsmouth. He had gone about a mile and a half when he saw his brother-in-law's horse standing alongside the road, calmly cropping grass. He didn't know if the horse had bolted or if the robbers had let it go. Either way, the horse was clearly a welcome sight.
Good boy.
preacher remounted and continued his journey as if nothing had happened. Preacher's first stop when he returned to Portsmouth was the bank. Going inside, he headed straight for Blanton's office.
Here, sir. You can't just go barging into Mr. Blanton's office.
Well, sure can. Blanton and I are old buddies now. Pushing the door open to Blanton's office, Preacher saw the banker staring down at the top of his desk. He was flanked on either side by Colby and McDougal. On the desk in front of Blanton was a cloth bag imprinted with the words, Ohio Bank for Savings. It was the same bag Preacher had gotten from Bert Rowe at the bank in Alexandria, and it was the same bag he had given up to the highwayman. Afternoon, Mr. Blanton. Preacher was carrying another sack, and from this sack he began pulling gold coins and putting them in little piles on the top of Blanton's desk. I believe you asked for payment in gold?
What the? Where the hell did you get that gold?
Well, you know exactly where I got it, Mr. Colby. You and McDougal were sitting in the saloon across from the bank when I cashed the bank drafts.
What? How'd you know we was there?
Shut up, McDougal.
And now, Mr. Blanton, if you please, I'd like the mortgage to my pa's place. With an angry look, Blanton got up from his desk and walked over to the cabinet, where he jerked open a drawer. After rifling through a few papers, he pulled one out, then came back and slapped it down on the desk in front of Preacher.
Here it is. Take the thing and be damned.
Preacher looked at the document for a moment, then handed it back to Blanton.
What now?
Well, I'd appreciate it if you'd write right here on the bottom, this debt is paid in full. Then sign your name, please.
Oh, for goodness.
Blanton did as Preacher asked, signing his name in large, illegible scrawl before returning the paper to Preacher. Preacher folded the paper carefully and put it in his pocket. Then he looked at the bag on Blanton's desk. You going fishing?
Fishing?
Yeah. Preacher opened the bank bag and pulled out a handful of rusty washers. I'm told these washers make real good weights. Since you aren't a mechanic, I can't think of any other reason you might have a bag full of them.
Fishing weights?
Blanton looked inside the bank bag, then frantically dumped the contents onto his desk.
You two idiots brought me fishing weights?
Well, how the hell was we supposed to know? They were in the bank bag he handed us and...
McDougal, shut the hell up!
Oh, yeah.
You were saying, McDougal?
Nothing.
Preacher began stacking the gold coins up on the desk. When he was finished with the coins, he piled up an equally high stack of the washers right alongside it. Then he put his finger on each one of them. Shouldn't be so hard on them, Blanton. When you stop and think about it, you put a bunch of iron washers in a bank sack, almost anyone might think they were gold coins.
You've got the deed to your father's farm now. I want you to take it, get the hell out of my office, and stay out.
Be happy to oblige. Oh, and it's been a real pleasure doing business with you.
I just wish I could have been a fly on the wall whenever old Klaas Blanton dumped out that sack and what he thought was gold turned out to be nothing but iron washers.
Now, Morgan, you mind yourself here.
It was a gala dinner, with Preacher's mother cooking everything she remembered as her oldest son's favorite. The whole family was laughing and talking, celebrating the fact that once more, the farm was owned free and clear. Despite the celebratory atmosphere, though, Preacher's father seemed unusually subdued.
Excuse me.
Preacher's father left the room. Did I do something wrong?
No, son. But your father is a proud man. When the rest of us learned what a wonderful thing you were doing, we went to him and begged him to accept this.
We finally convinced him, but it's not sitting well with him.
He'll get over it. He just needs a little time, that's all.
Yeah, I guess so. Y'all will excuse me.
Of course, Arthur.
Preacher got up and went to the front door. Peaceful out here.
Yeah.
Preacher walked over to stand beside his father. A streak of light raced across the sky.
Where's Fallen Star? They tell me the stars are really bright out in the mountains. Is that so?
Oh, yes, sir. Sometimes you get the notion you could just about reach up and pull one down.
Art, I don't want you to think I'm not grateful for what you did, paying off the mortgage and all.
I don't think that.
But it's hard for me to It's hard for me to accept something I didn't earn.
Paul, when a man has sons, he expects his sons to be a help to him until they get out on their own. Maybe they start small, picking up a few things here and there, and then maybe they move on up to feeding the stock, but the time comes when the son has to carry a full share of the load. Now, that happened with Morgan. He came of age and started carrying his full share of the load. But I never did. I left home. I deprived you of what you had every right to expect. I know that paying off this mortgage doesn't nearly pay you back for all that I owe you, but I hope it helps.
You'll be... Are we going on tomorrow?
Yes, sir.
Chasing the man who killed your woman.
Turns out he also killed the Potters over in Alexandria.
Yeah, I remember reading about that in Jim's newspaper. I reckon stopping someone like him is a noble enough deed. Just be careful. Even if you aren't going to stay here, it's nice to know you're alive somewhere.
I'll be careful, Pa.
Well, you'll always have a place to come to. I want you to know that, Preacher.
Thanks, Pa. I do know it, and I take comfort in it. It didn't escape Preacher's notice that his father called him Preacher. In doing so, Preacher knew his father was letting him know that he had forgiven his young son Arthur for leaving home so long ago, and now accepted Preacher on his own terms. For the first time in 15 years, Preacher was absolutely at peace with himself over that rash decision he had made while still a young boy. Ben Cavanis had thought that St. Louis was a big city. Philadelphia was 10 times bigger. He had never seen as much activity as he saw when he arrived in the city of brotherly love. He saw a lot of strange things, such as long wagons with several windows down each side, filled with seats on which people entered and left, seemingly without rhyme or reason. Someone referred to the wagon as an omnibus, when it was pulled by a single horse along rails of iron. In addition to the omnibuses, there were literally hundreds of wagons and carriages of all sizes and descriptions. Often, several of the wagons and carriages would congregate at a street intersection. Some of the drivers would blow through trumpets they carried, while others shouted impatiently as they tried to disentangle themselves. In addition to the wheeled vehicles, there were also men on horseback, though there were not nearly as many riders as there were drivers and passengers of the wheeled vehicles. Even the walks alongside the streets were filled with people, rushing to and fro, pushing, crowding as they hurried to wherever they were going. Cavanis saw a man standing on the corner waiting to cross the street, and he rode over to him.
Hey, you! Where can I find a man by the name of Epson?
I have no idea. No doubt there are scores of Epsons in Philadelphia, and even if I knew any of them, which I don't, I have no idea which one you're talking about.
At that moment, there was a break in the traffic, and the man walked quickly across the street. Cavanis inquired of several more people with an equal lack of success. He rode along slowly, taking everything in.
Mister, if you don't know what you're doing, get out of the road!
God damn.
Cavanis continued to ride up and down the streets, asking about Epson. Most of the time, he got no response of any kind, and those who did reply said they couldn't help him. It was nearly noon, and as he rode by a few of the restaurants, he could smell the aroma of cooking food. The smells reminded him that he was hungry. They also reminded him that he had no money. Seeing a hitching rail, Cavanis dismounted and tied off his horse.
Yeah. Mister, you can't leave your horse here.
Why not?
Only members can tie their horses or park their carriages here.
Only members of what?
Why, members of the Philadelphia Social Club, of course.
You member?
Do I look like a member dressed as I am?
The man was wearing a tricorn hat, a red jacket with brass buttons, and yellow pants tucked down into highly polished brown boots.
I don't know, you look pretty damn fancy dressed to me.
I am a sergeant-at-arms for the group. This is my uniform.
Well, they got him somebody from the army to look after things for him, do they? I never heard of such a thing. What do folks do in that club?
The same thing that they do in any club. They drink, eat, socialize, discuss matters of importance.
You don't say. Well, that sounds good to me, especially the eating part. I think I'll join.
That's very funny.
Oh, no, I'm serious. I'll join. Where do I go to join with them?
You have to apply for a membership, and you must have two sponsors who are already members. Then, when they vote on you, you must be unanimously accepted. If but one member blackballs you, you will not be allowed in. And if you are allowed in, then you must pay the entrance fees and the dues.
Well, how much is that?
If you have to ask, it is too much. Now please, take your horse and go somewhere else.
Grumbling, Cavanus remounted and rode away. He had never heard of such a thing as a private club. But if they ate and drank, it sounded fine to him. Maybe Epson could tell him how to get in. Or maybe Epson already belonged to such a club. That fancy-dressed sergeant had told him that he would have to know someone who already belonged in order to be a member. There was Epson. Two more times, Cavanus attempted to tie off his horse, but he was run away both times. Once because it was in front of someone's house, though the house was larger than any hotel Cavanus had ever seen. And the other time, he was told that the hitching rail was for customers only. He was beginning to wonder if there was any place in Philadelphia for a visitor to tie his horse. This was not what it was like back in St. Louis, where he knew which households he could go to begging for food. Now, with his ear cut off, he made such a terrifying appearance that women were afraid of him. And it was his experience that women would have nothing to do with men who frightened them. Cavanus continued to ride through the city until he reached an area where there were far fewer people. There he found a sapling, and at last was able to secure his horse. Looking around, he saw that though he was still in the city, this particular area had grass, shrubbery, and trees. It was actually a park, though park wasn't a term Cavanus would have recognized. Looking across an open area, he saw a man walking along a path. The path led down into a grove of trees, where it disappeared. Moving quickly, Cavanus hurried down to those same trees and followed the man along the path. Within minutes, the city seemed far away. So isolated were they could have been in the middle of deep woods somewhere. This was more to Cavanus's liking. Cavanus knew he would not get a better opportunity than this. Taking out his knife, he moved quickly up the path until he saw just ahead of him the man he had seen earlier. Walking quickly, Cavanus moved up on him so silently that his victim didn't even know Cavanus was there until he felt a hand clamp down across his mouth. Looking around to make certain nobody had seen him, Cavanus then bent down over the body and began searching his pockets. A moment later, he pulled out a wallet and was gratified to see that it contained $14 in paper money.
Well now, it appears as if my luck is changing.
Sticking the billfold into his own pocket, Cavanus hurried back to his horse, remounted, then rode to one of the restaurants. This time, when he tied off in front of the restaurant, he was not challenged.
Third murder victim found, like previous two, has throat cut. Philadelphia is being besieged with a string of gruesome murders. In but 2 weeks, three of our finest and most promising gentlemen have been killed by an unknown assailant in a manner so foul as to defy description. The most recent victim was Mr. E.G. Grant, age 31. Like the other two victims, Mr. Grant was found with his throat cut in a part of the city that is less traveled. It is believed that the murderer lies in wait in these more remote locations, picking his victims at a time when no one else is around to offer assistance. The constabulary force of Philadelphia is searching for this heinous killer and asks all to be on the alert for anything suspicious. Our citizens are cautioned against finding themselves alone in such areas, lest the killer strike again.
Theodore Epson put down his newspaper as an office boy approached his desk.
Mr. Epson?
Yes, Johnny, what is it?
Mr. Fontaine asked that you come to his office.
It had been some time since Fontaine had mentioned anything to Epson about the matter in St. Louis, and Epson thought that the matter was closed. Then he remembered that Miller was going to St. Louis.
Did he say what it was about?
No, sir, he didn't say.
Tell me, do you know if Mr. Miller has returned from St. Louis?
Yes, sir, he has. He's in Mr. Fontaine's office now.
Are the other members of the board there as well?
No, sir. Just Mr. Fontaine and Mr. Miller.
If none of the other board members were present, then it didn't seem very likely that anything was going to happen. Walking as if he had nothing to worry about, Epson crossed the bank to Fontaine's office.
Come in, Mr. Epson, come in. You remember Mr. Miller?
Yes, of course. How was your trip to St. Louis?
Tiring and disagreeable. St. Louis may call itself a city, but it is in fact nothing more than a frontier town. They have few of the amenities of a real city.
Have a seat, Mr. Epson.
Fontaine pointed to a comfortable chair that was close to his desk. This was a much better sign than the last time he was in here, when he was forced to sit in a hard, straight-back chair that was purposely set apart from the others.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller has a bit of disturbing news for us.
Oh, you have some disturbing news?
Yes. Well, disturbing in its content. Though, in one way, I suppose it is good news for you. Though not the way you would like to hear it, I'm sure.
What is it? I don't understand what you're talking about.
Mr. Miller, suppose you tell Mr. Epson what you told me?
Yes. Well, as you know, Mr. Epson, it was my intention, when I reached St. Louis, to question this Miss Jenny, to see what I could find out about all these claims she's been filing against you.
And did you interview her, sir?
No. I'm afraid that was not possible. When I arrived in St. Louis, I inquired about her at the bank, only to learn that she was dead.
Dead? Jenny is dead?
Yes. She was murdered.
Oh, my.
That means, of course, that the constant barrage of charges she has been lodging against you, whether spurious or valid, will stop.
Yes, sir. And I assure you, sir, they were spurious.
I'm sure that they were. At any rate, tragic though it may be, her demise is to your advantage.
Yes, sir, I suppose it is. I suppose it is good that I did not go to St. Louis to answer these charges, for if I had, I would surely be a suspect now.
That is so. But since you were clearly here in Philadelphia when the poor girl was murdered, you are not under any suspicion.
No, I wouldn't think that I would be.
Do they know who did kill her, Miller?
Seems she was attacked by two men, but one of them, a man by the name of Slater, was killed by her dog. They know there was another one because they found his ear. Seems the dog chewed it off.
Do they have any idea who the other one was?
They're looking for a man named Cavanus.
Cavanus?
Yes. Do you know him?
I know who he is. He was a ne'er-do-well who hung around town. A one-time fur trapper who wasn't very good at it, as I recall. How do they know he was involved?
They don't know for sure, but it seemed he and Slater had been seen together earlier that night, and Cavanus hasn't been seen since.
Terrible thing.
It is indeed. And one might say the poor girl was murdered because St. Louis is such a wild, frontier town that there is little law and less civil behavior. But I understand now that while I was gone, we had three murders in as many weeks right here in our own city of Philadelphia.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I was just reading about them.
Ironically, the poor souls who died here were killed in just as gruesome a fashion as was the lady in St. Louis. They died by having their throats cut. And that is exactly how the young lady of your acquaintance died.
I respectfully ask that you not refer to her as a person of my acquaintance, since that suggests that there was a relationship when clearly none existed.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply that you had a relationship with the lady.
Woman.
I beg your pardon?
As I've explained before, the woman in question is, she was a prostitute, a common whore. It seems to me inappropriate to call a harlot a lady.
Perhaps that is so, but I would hope you could be a bit more generous in your comments about her now that the poor lady is dead. After all, her untimely death has cleared you of all suspicion.
Yes, sir, it has indeed.
Epson was unable to prevent the smile from spreading across his face. So great was Epson's relief over how things had turned out that he didn't even notice the disapproving look Fontaine and Miller exchanged.
That is all, Mr. Epson. You may return to your work now.
Very good, sir.
When Epson returned to his desk, he pulled out the newspaper and attempted to read. Though he tried hard, he was unable to finish the story. He couldn't keep his mind off of the meeting he had just had with Fontaine and Miller. Was he responsible for Jenny's death? He could be. He knew that. In his last letter to Cavanaugh, he had been very specific about what he wanted. He'd wanted his troubles to go away, and he'd said exactly that in the letter. But he had not been specific as to how he meant for Cavanaugh to make those troubles go away. It now appeared as if Cavanaugh had decided that the only way to make that happen was by killing Jenny. Ebsen felt a momentary twinge of regret over that. He did not consider himself a criminal, even though he had taken $950 that didn't belong to him. Some might call him a thief for that, but in his mind, a thief was someone who stole by force or stealth, and he had done neither. Although he had not come by his windfall of $950 in what could be described as an honest way, he hadn't stolen it in any way that he would describe as theft. After all, the money had been dropped into his lap. He'd merely taken advantage of that, as he was sure any astute businessman would. He was not a thief, nor was he a murderer. He didn't kill Jenny, though now it seems certain that Cavanaugh did. And if Cavanaugh did kill her, it was surely in response to his specific instructions to make his problems go away. He wondered where Cavanaugh was now. If, as Miller said, his ear had been chewed off, there was a good chance Cavanaugh was dead somewhere. It'd be hard to stop the bleeding on a wound like that. Or maybe the wound could putrefy. Either one could kill him. When Preacher awoke, he got out of bed, walked over to the window of his hotel room, and looked out over the city of Philadelphia. Arriving by stagecoach after dark last night, he had gone to a hotel, deciding to start his search today.
Breakfast?
Preacher remembered now that when he'd arrived last night, he'd been asked if he would like breakfast delivered to his room in the morning. Crossing the room quickly, Preacher opened the door to see a young black boy, no more than 12 years old, holding a tray. From somewhere in the back of his mind, he knew that a tip was required, so he handed the boy a coin.
Thank you, sir.
Preacher put the tray on a table, pulled up a chair, and began having his breakfast. He shook his head when he compared this breakfast in a plush hotel room in a large eastern city with the breakfast he had eaten in the wilderness over the last several years.
Oh, boy, I better watch myself. I could learn to like this awful easy.
But even as he spoke the words, he knew that he couldn't really live like this. Already he was feeling restricted, and he missed the mountains that had become his home. He also realized that he was going to have to watch himself as far as speaking to himself out loud was concerned. It was a habit he'd developed in the wilderness, but that wasn't needed here. In a city the size of Philadelphia, he had plenty of opportunity to hear other voices and to speak to other people. There was no justification for speaking to himself, and if anyone did hear him, they might think him crazy. A newspaper had been delivered with his meal, and as Preacher put marmalade on his biscuit, he glanced through the paper. He had just raised the biscuit to take a bite when he read the headline over one of the articles.
Fourth victim found with throat cut.
Preacher read the story carefully, and by the time he finished both his breakfast and the newspaper, he was totally convinced that Ben Cavanaugh had arrived in Philadelphia.